I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root artist feature. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Roger Ruzzo, the band leader, if you will, of the Fourth Ward Afro Klezmer Orchestra. Roger, how are you?
I'm impressed that you said it all right in the first try. That's good. Doing well. Great.
Great. Well, glad to have you in. My first question, and I'm thinking about this from the perspective of our listeners. Can you talk about the tradition of klezmer music?
Okay.
And maybe how your band incorporates or plays around with that notion a little bit.
Klezmer, to briefly describe, people tend to think, give an idea of what klezmer is. Klezmer is sort of, people think Jewish music. People, I always say, think Fiddler on the Roof. Think those songs like that, usually almost consistently a heavy clarinet or violin melody that has a very Eastern European sort of feel. And klezmer music was more of a style of music. Well, it was that. There was that. But there was also – it's a lot broader than that, not just saying klezmer is sort of the genre. And then there's different kinds of styles, like there's doñas and horas and or horos, depending on what part, as an example of two types of dance and style of song, and fast or slow. And the music was from Eastern Europe, probably coming about in the 19th century, when we think of it as being organized as klezmer. Klezmer meaning the musicians. It's actually klezmer. It's actually two words, meaning the instrument and the music. We do a little research on that. Right at the moment, my brain's a little foggy. So, but then it became not just Jewish music, really. It was Eastern European music. It was the folk music of Ukraine and Poland and Russia. And you had the gypsy musicians and Jewish musicians. And I won't go into the whole sort of sociopolitical thing too much, but one of the reasons was it was a style of music that was popular. And these were the musicians that played most of it. And it was gypsy and Jewish folk songs. But there was also a lot of songs from the peoples of the area, you know, who were non-Jewish or non-gypsy. And so you have a lot of, you know, like I said, Russian, Ukrainian, Polish folk melodies, Romanian, Bulgarian. So we're still talking these Eastern European Balkan areas. And so that's the klezmer style, which I've gone into. And then what happened was there was around the late 19th century, you began to immigrating into the United States. And it really became klezmer music about the late 19th, early 20th century, when these musicians who'd played these particular styles and had immigrated to the U.S. And it became – there was all these whole communities, for instance, in New York in the 20s, there was a thriving in the early part of the 20th century. There's a thriving Jewish community that spoke only Yiddish, and there was just like a lot of communities today, like in the nature of America, and there was a whole series of Yiddish theater with, you know, Yiddish plays and you know, Yiddish comedians and Yiddish music, klezmer music. Klezmer music was very popular, and the klezmer music was this vast dancing, you know, exuberant style, and that had a lot of party sort of atmosphere to it. And that's a sort of a brief mishmash idea of klezmer. And actually, back up, it says there were actually even large ensembles. There were big klezmer big bands. Abe Schwartz, the first one that comes to mind, back in the 20s and 30s, he was really hugely popular. Then it sort of began to dwindle away during the Second World War and during the 50s and even in the 60s, you know, and it was still, of course, there. But then you had Fiddler on the Roof, and there was this huge revitalization in the early 60s. When did that come out? 62, 63. And so that's where you began to see, began to have a rebirth and became, you know, more prominent in the culture. Let me back up. That's not true. It's not prominent in the culture because people are still going, what's klezmer? I don't even know. So I say Jewish music. You say, and I say fiddler. And so there's a long rambling discourse on klezmer music.
Well, let's add a layer to that and talk about Afro-klezmer music. So what does that mean in general, or maybe even specifically, what does that mean in terms of your take on it?
Afro-klezmer has to do with taking the idea of klezmer in Jewish music and integrating it with West African rhythm styles and music styles. I was originally, when I came up with the idea, I was thinking Fela and integrating Fela. And then really what occurred to me was an album that Cannonball Adderley, the great saxophonist, and became hugely famous with his work with John Coltrane. Miles Davis, a quintet who John Coltrane was in. That was the Kind of Blue record with that quintet. And Cannonball did a record called Fiddler on the Roof, where he covered all these klezmer tunes from Fiddler, and he did these jazz versions of them. And I was like, Cannonball Adderley was the first Afro-klezmer because he was really doing these styles. Not to say that other people, other African-Americans weren't doing them, other people from Africa weren't doing them, but this is my understanding of it, where he really was consciously taking these styles and integrating them with a West African style, specifically jazz music. And so I thought, okay, there's the Afro-klezmer right there. So we have Afro-Cuban, we have Afro-pop, Afro-reggae, all these different kinds of things. Why not Afro-klezmer? You know, and I began to, just listening to the two styles separately and began to hear there's so many similarities in the music, specifically with, rhythm and even basic harmonies and ideas that were like, they're not too different except for some scales and modes, which even, on a basic level, you can go, hey, it works fine, And so why not have more jazz and funk and Afro pop, and integrate these styles and call it Afro klezmer. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So
yeah.
You take Fiddler on the Roof and Fela and even add a little bit of jazz, blend that up together. And in thinking about that integration, what was your biggest challenge?
What was my biggest challenge? My biggest challenge was finding someone to play all this stuff.
Okay. Sounds about right.
Yeah, that was what I was sitting. I had the idea when I was sitting in the Highland Ballroom, which the Highland Inn, which
yeah.
It used to be, which is, it's not, they're not doing shows there anymore except for private events and whatever. But I was just sitting down there one night and I think I was having a drink, seeing, I don't remember what show I was seeing. Actually, you know what it was? I think it might have been Kina Boto's Drummers. Might have been one of the performances that I saw that night. But I was thinking about this and I was just began sketching ideas out on a napkin and began writing basic ideas for songs. And that's when I came with it. It's like Afro-klezmer. That's when it sort of, had that epiphany. And I began to figure out, okay, I had sat there and sketched out the ideas for about three different tunes and then went home and wrote them out and arranged them. And then my next thought was, who the hell is going to play this? I know lots of people have been playing in the Atlanta music scene by this time, good 15, 16 years. So I just knew a lot of really fantastic musicians in town. I got some of my friends to come out and say, you want to try this? And they're looking at me kind of sideways going, okay, Roger. Okay, sure. We'll humor you, but they liked it, And so subsequently I was able to, just keep writing ideas with this genre in mind, if you will, this new genre of music.
So let's add the fourth ward on top of that, because that's more so Atlanta. You take the klezmer, the Afro. Now let's talk about the the Fourth Ward. What was your approach in trying to bring all of that to Atlanta?
Well, the Fourth Ward actually comes from, I was coming up with an idea, you know, it's like, what the heck do I call this? I was thinking Afro Klezmer. All right, so Afro Klezmer Orchestra, and as Ben Davis, great saxophonist who was playing with us at the time, said, well, there's a whole hell of a lot of us. So, yeah, okay, orchestra makes sense. And then Fourth Ward is because that's pretty much where the band started rehearsing, because my third or fourth dilemma, among other things, was where the heck am I going to rehearse these guys? Because I was living in a place that was like, not going to be able to get nine guys to rehearse here. And in my house, my wife would have been like, no. No, that's not happening too much. You know, it's like maybe, you know, once or twice, but no. And I talked to Robert Cheatham, who was was one of the heads of iDrum. What was that? That's probably about 7 years ago when he was last affiliated with them. And maybe 6 years ago, because it's about how long we've been together. And I said, can he was letting us rehearse at iDrum, which is, you know, the old iDrum three incarnations ago, which is in the Fourth Ward. And I was like, okay, so it's Fourth Ward, you know, and then Afro Klezmer Orchestra. So, and Fourth Ward being right, you hit it on the head. It's like an affiliation with Atlanta. And like, you know, and constantly I'm explaining to people, especially when we go on the road, it's like, Fourth Ward, that's in New Orleans. I was like, no, that's the Ninth Ward that you're thinking about, which was so devastated by Katrina. But no, we have the Fourth Ward, which is part of the historic African-American district in Atlanta that was a seat for the burgeoning culture that became, you know, what is historically, well, I just said it, you know, because this is historically famous African-American culture from Atlanta. I guess it was, what was that? It was kind of the... I guess you had the upper middle class areas, but then interestingly enough, but also you had Buttermilk Bottom, which was up the street too.
Exactly.
So I guess they all maybe ran together.
Yeah. But. Now, when it comes to the music, and I think about the storytelling in the music, and I guess more so, I guess narrative might be a better word. And when I think about the music of Fela Kuti, there may be a song, well, many songs, but there might be 7 or 8 minutes of just instrumentation before there's even one word being spoken or sung. But you sort of get the energy and the narrative that still comes from that instrumentation. And I feel like in a very similar way, when I listen to your music, that there's a narrative in the instrumentation. So talk about maybe how you craft a narrative with your music.
So starting with the narrative, it starts with a melody, and then you've got let me back up. I'm about these days one half of the songwriting composition team for the Afro Klezmer Orchestra right now. Jeff Crompton's been writing a lot of music, and he's written a lot of really great songs for the group as well. And I can't speak for his composition style, but when I'm writing, I'm thinking about melody first. And you have the melody is it's what's giving you the song. It's what's giving you the idea that's drawing you into the whole experience of the music. And, you know, why if you don't have a good melody, why do you care? You know, I mean, there's some great stuff with rhythm. It's great stuff with harmony. I mean, this is, of course, talking from strictly personal perspective. But, you know, and that's all exquisitely important, of course. But, you know, the melody is where, you know, where we have our connection, our internal recognition of the voice, you know, which is, you know, the most perfect instrument, as they say, whoever they are. But that we are taking that melody and moving into melody will tell a story, you know, and it trying to create. I'm trying to create like sort of like mini tone poems, you know, and just a short musical experience that tells a story that can be understood and, you know, internalized without having to have like have words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need words, but words definitely are a difficult monster to handle. You know,
I'm curious also, given the amount of time that you all have been an orchestra, a band, talk about keeping everyone or everything together.
Well, from the original ensemble that started, was it 98 was a longer time ago. It's 2008. Approximately, it's myself and Jeff Crompton and Bill Nittler. And, am I forgetting somebody? No, that's about the only three original members. We've had a lot of people who've come in and out. Colin Bragg, but Colin just took a little hiatus, about 3 months ago. So I could say Colin had been with us since 2008 too, since the very beginning. But it's about the music, and so it's not necessarily about band. I think it's another reason why I like prefer to use the word orchestra. I try to avoid using the word band because there's this – it's almost pejorative in my mind, because you say band and you're like, oh, we've got a band. This is the band and the guys in the band, and you know we can't do that because, you know, it's not with the band idea. It's like, no, it's about the music. You know, it's like you look at like someone like what Mingus did. Mingus was writing for the music, and he had great people who stayed with him forever. You know, Booker Ervin played with him for the longest time. You know, and but still, he had so many other musicians, you know, that changed in his ensemble because, you know, he was thinking about the music. And so, I mean, it's keeping the ensemble together is just about continuing to write, trying to write good music and write something that's interesting and different. And so that's how the ensemble, I believe, stays together. And, you know, and there's other perks, you know, that trying to be considerate of what is occurring in an ensemble that size. And then, you know, not being too restrictive on people's creative expression. You know, it's like when I write something, I write music and I try to compose it, especially what you mentioned about the size of the ensemble. I have no idea how many people I'm really going to be able to get for things. At least at the beginning, I wasn't. It's a little bit better now, but could change in a minute. I don't know. I haven't spoken to anybody in 24 hours. Might have changed. You never know. But we're talking about the instant response a dilemma we have now in the 21st century. It's like, I don't know. I haven't heard from them in 24 hours. Heck, they all might have, you know, might have quit. I don't know. They've all joined their own. But keeping the ensemble together is about writing for things, you know, having to write music that, if necessary, can be played for as a group with as small as four or five. Undesirable, because that's not what I'm orchestrating or arranging, but possible and still will sound good.
Let me ask you something about that orchestra versus band concept, because as you talk about the commitment to the music and having it be having that be what drives the orchestra versus a band, where I think sometimes we get both within the band, quote unquote, and with the public, we get emotionally attached to the construction of the band. And when there's a different drummer, or if you switch out a lead singer, like there's some sort of emotional commitment, whether you're talking about Van Halen or, you know, like I just think about how there are all of these different ways in which we have an emotional tie to how bands change. But with an orchestra, there's a different sense of emotional attachment with that. So from that emotional place, does that make it easier for you to have an open door for people to come and go versus the band constraint, where once you leave the band, it may be harder to have those constructive comings and goings, if you will?
Well, something. I was in a group, an Atlanta group called Gold Sparkle Band. I still am, I guess. We're going to have some shows in June, but I mean, they moved up to New York. Charles Waters and Andrew Barker moved up to New York about 2000, 1999, 2000. And, but before that, when I was in the band, we were all living in Grant Park area, and I was booking a lot of music. We were touring, weirdly enough. I mean, it's always seems interesting to me that we were touring as, you know, free jazz ensemble. And an incident happened where I had been working on a tour through a good chunk of like sort of the middle Atlantic states. And I was about 3 weeks into the tour, you know, having it booked. And a member of the band comes to me and says, "Oh, I've got to play with my, I can't do that." You know, and I was like, you know, and this has been something we've been talking about for a while, about booking it and doing the work and contacting, you know, if you're involved with that stuff, you understand the work that's involved. And I got, you know, a response from him that said, "Oh, by the way, I've got a gig with my metal band at Dottie's," which was a bar, a well-known bar over off, right, actually right up the street from here, over Memorial, right across from Oakland. And I was like, it's like, we've been booking this for weeks and you've got one night where you're going to go play. And, you know, and I was putting it in my own sort of, you know, from my own selfish perspective, saying, "God, how could you do this?" You know? And then I began to think, it's like, you know, ensembles are made up of people and people have lives and people are going to, they're going to do whatever it is that's in their life that is important to them. And the group is about, you know, its existence is the music. The music is the reason for the existence. You know, it's not just like a group of, you know, personalities, which, I mean, it is when you mentioned Van Halen. Yes, that was some great stuff in some ways, I thought, you know, but it was obviously a conglomeration of personalities that, you know, disintegrated for whatever reasons. But it, you know, became about personalities. It no longer became about music, which is, you know, which leads to suckage, you know, on a lot of levels. Because the personalities interfere with the music, and then it's like, you know, you've destroyed your whole reason for existing. And so I began to like, I was pissed off for a little while. And then I was like, you know what? I mean, you know, the band didn't break up, but, you know, or anything was even remotely close to happening. But it made me realize it's like, you have to adjust for these things. And you can't necessarily be have expectations of individuals that they're going to be going, "Oh, well, I'm going to devote my entire life to this." And because, you know, we have this idea, which is wonderful when you're 19 or 20. But, you know, as you become an adult and you realize you have responsibilities and things going on in your life and other things going on, you know, that's not so much a great thing. And so the band idea is immature, is what I see it. That's my perspective. Other people might disagree. But it's about the music. And so that's one of the reasons why, back to an earlier point about the music, why I write the music the way I do, which occasionally limits some of the potential for the orchestration and arranging, but is that I don't know who's always going to be there to play it. Because, you know, like I said, people have to eat. And so sometimes it's like, well, this gig might be paying this amount of money or maybe not so much. And so now, you know, I'm going, you know, I'm you know, asking guys, well, we might get this. And they're like, well, I got a kid or two. And so I can't do it because I got to take this gig, or if this other gig comes up. And I'm like, okay, I understand. So that's back to your point, a long rambling response to your band question, which you can edit to your leisure or kill. But the whole band idea is subservient to the idea of what is the real reason for the existence, which is the music.
Yeah, yeah. And just to clean up that Van Halen reference, what I wanted to also add was, some people are Van Halen fans with David Lee Roth, some fans or Van Halen fans with Sammy Hagar. And those camps are often split in terms of when someone left the band and the energy changed. So that's for those keeping score at home.
Do you happen to know anybody who's a Van Halen fan with Sammy Hagar?
They exist.
I didn't ask you that. I said, do you know of any? I mean, I'm sure they exist.
I not off the top of my head.
Right, right. I mean, you know, there are people who are still flat earth theorists, you know, but I mean, just to make a point, I
right,
was like saying,
right.
Sure.
Yeah. But going back to that sort of fluid concept of where your orchestra is, how do you record? Because when we talked off air about your latest or your most recent work from a few years ago, Abdul the Rabbi, I think about how you record the music, because if you don't often know from moment to moment who will be performing the music live, what was your approach in trying to get everyone or who all was necessary to get to record the music?
To get them to record the music was a question of scheduling. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody in the ensemble has been and is still continues to be all consummate professionals. And so these things need to be, you know, adjusted for, you know, what are schedules and, you know, and availability. And so Abdul the Rabbi was recorded, which I have to point out, make an aside. Do you know the Mighty Hannibal, or you know of the Mighty Hannibal? He just passed away, but he was a soul singer, an Atlanta soul singer, who was had a couple hits back in the late 60s and early 70s, and he was experiencing a little bit of a resurgence of interest, reinterest in his music from actually Django Unchained. Had some songs in it that Tarantino movie from a couple of years back had some songs in it that were variations that they used some of his music. But he was a very interesting gentleman, and he always made a point about asking me what I meant by that name, Abdul the Rabbi, where does that come from? And you know, and I said, well, he said, well, I was like, what is rabbi? And he told me, this is like, I don't know, but I said, he asked me what a rabbi was. I said, well, rabbi is pretty much means teacher. And he said, well, Abdul means slave. It's like, you know, that's effed up, man. And he laughed at me. He's like, yeah, I love that. You know, you have to hear the Mighty Hannibal talk to understand the context of it. But I was just thinking about that you mentioned when I hear it, because I always think of I hear his take on it in my head and a lot of other aspects. But recording the record, the first record we did, East Atlanta Passover Stomp, was done pretty much live. We did it at Griffin Studios, Chris Griffin Studios, the great Atlanta engineer, who had a setup in his studio, and we just did live takes. And the second one, so that was, you know, getting everybody there, which is actually a little bit more difficult than that was the first record. East Atlanta Passover Stomp was the first record, and the second record was Abdul the Rabbi. Because Abdul, we did a lot of tracking and we dubbed it, which it's interesting with regard to feeling, because you got Abdul, you know, is all these different tracks and how do they fit? And it's such a long, involved process when you're multi-tracking and overdubbing. Whereas with, you know, live recording, you got bam, that's it. So it's got to be, you got to hit it. You got to be happy with it. It's got to be something that, you know, in my experience with the recording, that I listen to it and I have to listen to it and go, is it giving me a knot in my stomach? Can I listen to, will I be able to hear this in 5 years and not, you know, want to drink a half a pint of whiskey immediately because it was like, oh, we missed that, or, you know, whatever, you know, no regrets. And so with your question about scheduling, it was just a matter of, or getting everybody together is about scheduling. And so we find that day and find the day with the studio, and it's sometimes it's a crapshoot, but, you know, for the most part, that's not the biggest issue. It's just making sure that everything's freaking fantastic.
So what's inspiring you right now?
What's inspiring me right now? The MARTA bus driving by was hearing a rhythm out of that. and hearing that combined with what sounded to be an Onyx tune coming out of somebody's car driving in an opposite direction, combined with I was hearing like a sort of, honestly, a sort of klezmer melody-ish coming out of my head, which is like a, something original. It's like sort of like, you know, sometimes I wake up in the morning and I hear music in my head, you know. Weird enough, I have dreams of music. I have music in my dreams occasionally. Occasionally I'll have like, you know, I'll get up and write it down just to see what it is. Just like, wow, that's weird. I'm hearing music in my dreams. And so that's what was inspiring me. Inspiration is a really, really tricky bird to catch. And because it's about really, I find, just doing lots and lots of stuff and then seeing, you know, if I like it, if it works.
Roger?
Yes, Floyd.
Let everyone know where they can find out more or find out the latest with the Fourth Ward Afro-Klezmer Orchestra.
Well, there's our website, www.afroklezmermusic.com. Or to make it easier, there's the Facebook and the SoundCloud and the Bandcamp and everything. But to make it easier on all you listeners, all six of you out there, I will say that, or 6,000 of you out there, or everybody in Baden-Baden who's tuning in right now, just look for us. We're one of the most successful Afro-Klezmer orchestras in the Atlanta area. So just type in Afro-Klezmer and you probably will come across any number of things that will lead you to our pictures and our music.
Roger Ruzzo, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Floyd. And Wonderroot. Thanks to Wonderroot.